apply it and hopefully to really other areas of our marriage as well.
Goal setting would be wrong. A second would be money. Spending money in a marriage requires mutual consent. And one of the reasons why couples sometimes argue and fight about money is because somebody feels they have control. And by the way, there should be mutual consent in terms of spending money, regardless of who makes the money. In a marriage, there's no such thing as my money and your money. It's our money. We're a team. We're a unit. The fact that I earn income and my wife, you know, is a stay-at-home mom is irrelevant. It's still our money. And if it's our money, by the way, we should both have access to it. We should both know where it is. And there should be mutual consent in terms of what we're spending it on. Let me just stick with this. Let me just go with this a little bit further. I'll get back to the idea of mutual consent, but we're on this tangent of money, which is an interesting topic, so I just want to go a little bit further with it. I think it's a good idea for a husband and wife to develop a family budget. To actually go line item by line item through their expenses and agree on how much are we going to spend on different things. To develop mutual consent little by little. Now, many of these line items, there's nothing to discuss. I mean, for example, if you have a mortgage on the house, so you're going to pay whatever the mortgage on the house is. There's no negotiation. There's no discussion. Many things, there's something to discuss. I mean, how much are we going to spend on clothing? How much are we going to spend on entertainment? How much are we going to spend on vacations? I mean, there's a lot of things that are, you know, not necessarily necessities. Even within the line of necessities, like, for example, clothing, I mean, you know, there's quite a range as to what a couple could do. So, now let me ask you a question. Let's say we're talking about the topic of, I'll just make something up, vacations. And your wife says, well, let's budget $20,000 a year for vacations. And you say, well, it seems a little steep. I think maybe I'd be more comfortable with something like $10,000 a year. So how does that get resolved? So most people would say, well, you negotiate, you know, you settle somewhere in between. If you can settle somewhere in between, then you have mutual consent. Now you don't have a disagreement anymore. We agreed to $15,000. But that's not my example. My example is you want to spend $20,000, your wife wants to spend $10,000.
Vice versa.
Oh, sorry. Vice versa. You want to spend whatever it was. And how do we resolve that? So what's the principle? The driving principle is we need mutual consent. At $10,000, we have mutual consent. And so it always defaults to the lower number. You have mutual consent there. You don't compromise at $15,000. At $15,000, somebody feels violated. Somebody feels like, wait a second, no, this is our money, and this is money that I don't feel comfortable spending. So it defaults to the lower number. So money is an example of the importance of mutual consent. Another example is parenting. Significant parenting decisions, they're not my children. They're our children. I don't have the right to parent unilaterally. It's a violation of my wife's rights, let's say. It has to be mutual consent when something significant occurs. We don't answer, we shouldn't answer our child. We should, well, I'll get back to you. I have to speak to Ima. I have to speak to Abba. Now, of course, that's frustrating to them, but it's also a good example to them. And then you discuss it, you have to try to find mutual consent. This gives me the opportunity, actually, to go on another tangent, if you don't mind. Which is, let's say, for example, you have a major, you know, a major issue that you're discussing, and you can't resolve it. It's not financial, so that there's not this rule that it defaults to the lower amount. But let's say it's something like parenting. and you've discussed it, and you can't get through it. You want to do X, your wife wants to do Y. And you discuss it the next day, can't get through it. And you've applied all the conflict resolution techniques you've ever learned. You've learned about Venus, your wife has learned about Mars. At the end, you just can't get through this. This will happen. I mean, no matter how good a marriage is, husbands and wives will get to the point where there's something on the table that we can't resolve. What do you do? So what I'm going to share with you has worked for my wife and I every single time. And I'm a big proponent of it. Not only that, but I think it's actually a really important, for those of you who have children that are not yet married and are possibly entering that parsha, I think this is a really important question for people to ask when they're dating. To talk about this, what I'm about to share with you, to talk about this. And if somebody's not prepared to agree to this, it's a huge red flag. So again, there's a dispute you can't resolve, what do you do? So my wife and I have an understanding that if there's ever anything that we can't resolve, we are ready and willing to go to a mutually agreed upon, again, mutual consent, mutually agreed upon objective third-party professional who will essentially resolve it for us, somebody that we trust. In our case, and in probably many other cases, it would be a rough. Right? Somebody that knows your family, somebody you trust, you go to and say, look, we're not here for advice. We're not here to like analyze this to the desk. We've already done that. We can't get through it. We trust you. We know you have our family's best interest in mind. Here's what I think. Here's what my wife thinks. What do you think we should do? And 20 minutes later, we walk out of there. It's done. It's over. And of course, when you're on the side where the Rav says, you're right, you know, I think, so that's easy. But when it comes out that it's like my wife wanted to do it, I'll tell you, I don't know what your experience will be if you end up doing this, but my experience is, I must have been missing something. I'm really okay with it. It wasn't so easy to concede to my wife. If it was, we wouldn't have been in his office. But I must have been missing something because this person, I mean, I trust this person. Tremendous wisdom. Tremendous insight. It's a Talmud Chacham. I'm okay with it. And that's over. Otherwise, sometimes these things can linger, you know, for years. And there's no way to get resolution, or resolution is attained, but there's resentment following. So getting back to the dating, I think it's a really important question. Because if somebody's not willing to agree to this, then you have to ask the question, okay, so then how do you want to overcome disputes that we can't get through? There usually is no other answer. I mean, because sometimes, we've talked about it. Like, this is the example here is not that if we've talked about it and got through it, then you're talking about a different scenario. I'm talking about the scenario where we can't get through it. How do you want to resolve that? If somebody can't subjugate themselves to the will of another, it's an indication of a level of arrogance. Mm-hmm. It's scary. I mean, that level of arrogance, or sometimes it's a need to control. Controlling personalities are very dangerous in marriage. And that could be a huge red flag in dating.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So what if you had a patient or a close friend that was already in a marriage, where it's clear that one spouse is unwilling to even agree about a third party or to the concept, what would you advise in that situation?
Right, so you could try to discuss with this person the whole concept of the third party. And here's the way I like to put it to them. Because I'm not dealing with people that are dating usually, I'm dealing with people in marriage. And very often in marriage I come across exactly this scenario. So, and a lot of times it's with parenting issues. So I'll suggest that that one spouse speaks to the other and gives this example. Okay, so you don't want to agree to you don't want to agree to go to a agreed upon third party. So that means what? That means you want to just unilaterally parent? What does that mean? So how do you want to resolve this? Usually the person that doesn't want to go to the third party, that's what they mean. I don't care what he thinks. I'll tell you what I think. They're controlling. So they want to set up this environment where it's okay to unilaterally parent. So, okay. So I have an idea. I forgot to tell you, but last week, I registered the boys in a fundamentalist Islamic school in Iran. And we're flying tomorrow. What do you think? Oh, you don't think that's a good idea? Well, so? I mean, if we can unilaterally parent, so you could be on the other end of that. Do you really want to set up a marriage? Do you really want to set up a parenting situation where that's what we're doing to each other? I mean, it really is. It's like, you know, in the case of money, right, I call it financial rape. I mean, it's really, it's a violation. You know? And you really want to set up a marriage where we're just doing what we want to do when we want to do it, regardless of what the other person thinks. You could try to have a conversation, you know, like that. Now, you might say, you know, my friend, at the end of the day, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to imagine what the response would be. Like
so sometimes it helps them see that if they continue with that attitude in their marriage, that ultimately they're going to be on the other end of that. And it doesn't feel nice. I mean, if they can do it, then their spouse can do it. And they're going to end up destroying their family. That would be the first thing I would try. So just one more quick idea on this concept of mutual consent. It's very important. There's two qualities that are really important in life and in marriage. Courage is important. It's important to have courage. What does it mean? Courage is the ability to believe in certain things and to align your life with those beliefs. But taken too far, that quality of courage can become a curse. What's that look like? It looks like somebody who's controlling, manipulative. It's my way or the highway. When I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. And so that quality of courage has to be balanced with consideration. What's consideration? Consideration is the ability to consider another, to be accommodating, easygoing, and helpful. Wonderful quality. However, taken too far, that quality can also become a curse. What's that look like? That looks like somebody who's people-pleasing, conflict-avoiding. You don't know what they stand for, because what they stand for is a function of who they're standing around, the circumstances they're standing in. They're like a chameleon. So a lot of people are heavily inclined towards one or the other. Courage or consideration. Generally speaking, somebody who's overboard on courage marries somebody who's overboard on consideration. And this results often in the person who is overboard on courage being quite forceful in the marriage. And the person who's overboard on consideration subjugating themselves to the other's will. Eventually, the person who's overboard on consideration builds up so much anger and resentment that what they've wanted has never mattered. Their input was never considered. Their opinion was never solicited. That they sometimes snap and decide, that's it. Now things are going to be my way, and I'm going to take control. And then the person who was overblown on courage starts to feel, oh my gosh, my whole family's like ready to blow up. I better let her have her way. Do things the way she wants. So the irony here is that they just switched roles. If it didn't work when he was controlling and she was subjugating herself to him, it's not going to work when she's controlling and he's subjugating himself to her. The goal is to be able to balance courage with consideration. To be able to have the wisdom to assess a situation and ask, what does this call for? Does this call for courage or does this call for consideration? And if it calls for courage, then I'm going to bring courage. If it calls for consideration, then I'm going to bring consideration. Most people can't do this. Most people are a victim to their inclination. And you can see in their lives a whole series of successes and a parallel series of failures. And it's really luck. Like, let's say you've got somebody who's overborn on courage. So you can see these successes lined up in their life. It's really luck. The circumstances called for courage. They're way overboard on courage. It's all they know. It was a perfect fit. And over here, they've got these series of failures. It was luck or bad luck. The circumstance called for consideration. They don't have the ability. And so they keep failing over and over. Kind of like, you know, there's an expression, he was a hammer thinks everything is a nail. Mm-hmm. I'm not very handy. We occasionally have handymen come to the house. We give him a whole list, you know, and he's got the tool belt and he pulls out the tool he wants. Imagine if he came and I didn't see the tool belt. Where are your tools? Here it is. What do you mean, here it is? I didn't give you the list yet. Doesn't matter. It's crazy, right? First you got to look at the list. Then you pull out the tool that's going to work. We have to be able to develop whatever that energy is that is not our inclination. So if I'm inclined to courage, okay, when the situation calls for courage, this is going to be easy for me. I'm going to like this. But when the situation calls for consideration, I have to be smart enough to recognize that. And I have to work hard at developing that energy so that I can be successful in those situations also.
Do you mind if I ask you to back up to the beginning?
Yeah, sure.
So you talked about the three C's and that we have to get rid of them. So what do you do if you want to try to affect some change?
Right. Okay. So now we're leaving the topic of mutual consent.
Oh, wait till the end.
No, it's fine. Seriously. It's perfect timing.
Okay.
So just to
okay.
Everybody.
I have a question about the mutual consent, but
No, I can wait. Go ahead.
Do you both agree about that?
Before we move on.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I got your question.
Okay. You should sign it.
You know, we come at things from a little different database. I'm a psychotherapist and do a lot of marital therapy, which I believe is two individual therapies simultaneously, but I do marital therapy. And a lot of my patients, they really are, want to walk out that third floor window. They do not buy the notion of mutual consent as a given, as a law of marriage. And the havoc that ensues from that is obvious. Any thoughts on different ways to deal with that fundamental different worldview where both persons don't subscribe to the mutual consent notion?
Well, why don't they subscribe to it?
I earn the money. I mean, all the things you said, you earn the money, or the woman's in charge of the kids, you know, they're my kids. My kids too, no, but I'm the mom. You know, whatever, you can come up with any number of scenarios, but always, obviously false justifications or invalid, yeah. but still that they hold to it tenaciously.
Yeah. And one of the things you could say, or sometimes I say, how's that working for you?
Oh, okay.
I mean, like, if they're sitting in our office.
Right, exactly.
You know, like, how's that working for you?
But that takes a logical mind to answer. And there's too much emotional investment in your position that often they say, well, it works lousy, but I'm right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that then you enter a discussion about the meaning of being right in a marriage.
Yeah.
Like, maybe you are right, but do you want to be right or do you want to be happily married?
Yeah. I've challenged people to say, what does winning mean?
Yeah.
You know? And often I'm able to get them to see that winning really means when the other guy wins. Not always, but I help them to see that they really want their spouse to feel good about the relationship and that it's not a contest. You know?
The other thing that you can, that I sometimes ask is, it's an interesting worldview. Where'd you get that? Like, what's the source?
My parents, of course.
What do you think? And how did it work for them?
Well, they got divorced when I was 12. My parents didn't. Good question.
But in other words, to ask them to explore, even sometimes give them a week or two to do it. You know, go online, you know, go purchase books on modern psychology or ancient wisdom or like wherever. Please, it's an interesting worldview. I'd like to explore it with you. You know, can you find for me a source that's going to indicate to me that that's true and that it works. You know, because this really gets back to my first point about there being principles of the universe that work or don't work. I mean, here's sometimes, for whatever reason, when it comes to medicine, when it comes to accounting, when it comes to real estate, when it comes to whatever, pretty much everybody agrees that there are these principles that govern the success or failure. Why is it that people think, when it comes to relationships, that it's just a matter of subjective opinion? It's really crazy, you know? So sometimes I'll ask them to please check it out. See if there's anybody out there that actually agrees with this, you know, and has found this to work. But I'm not suggesting that this is the answer to your question, because, you know, I also experience with certain clients, real frustration. Sometimes they are just so invested, emotionally invested in a certain worldview, they're going to go down with the ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it's not till the third marriage that they're ready to acknowledge that the one thing that all those marriages had in common, besides them being right, was them. They were in all three. And sometimes it takes a lifetime for somebody to realize that, and that's when they become open. So if the three C's, criticize, condemn, and complain, don't work, so what's an alternative?
Well, not that they don't work. You said
it shouldn't be done.
Right.
So there are a few options. One is to let me offer the first one by way of example. So this works great with kids too, by the way. I love it when you. So instead of criticizing what they don't do, articulate what you love when they do it. Just human nature is such that people like opportunities to succeed. They like to feel like they're a hero. They like to feel like they decided to take an initiative that worked. I love it when you X, Y, Z. You're kind of like putting out there an opportunity for them to do something that they know they're going to end up feeling successful doing. They're going to succeed to make you happy. So that's one possibility. A second possibility is to demonstrate whatever it is that you want to criticize in a fanatical way. Fanatical. I believe, maybe the rabbi can help me with this, but I believe there's a commentary on, the new king came to power and didn't know Yosef. And that essentially led to the slavery. And when the plagues came, Moshe Rabbeinu was the one to initiate all the plagues, right? He took the staff, he did this, he whatever, except for the second and third plague. Right? The first and the second. The first, Hashem asked Aaron to take the staff and to hit the water. And then it turned to blood.
First three,
thank you. Yeah, sorry. And he also Aaron had to hit the dirt, and then the frogs, right? The lice came. Thank you, for helping me through this Devar Torah. I should stick with marriage. Anyway, so Rashi, I think there says that it would have been would have lacked appreciation for Moshe Rabbeinu to hit the water or the dirt, because he was saved by the water and saved by the dirt, because the dirt was what he used to bury the Egyptian that killed the Jew. So that's the Rashi. But then somebody, I heard somebody ask, well, appreciation and gratitude to water, to dirt? I mean, it's a little nutsy. I mean, it's inanimate. Do they have feelings? So I heard somebody answer once that that it is a fanatical demonstration of appreciation. And that's exactly what the Jews had to try to teach the Egyptians before they left. Because ultimately it comes back to the king not appreciating what Yosef did for them that led to the whole thing to begin with. And I think that's a wonderful example for us in our marriage. When we want to try to effectuate change in our home, not the only thing, but one of the things we should be trying is to demonstrate whatever change we want to see in a fanatical way, rather than preaching it, but to live it. You know. So if we want to elevate the level of gratitude in our marriage or in our home, so instead of catching everybody doing something wrong, every single day, I'm going to catch everybody in my family doing something right. And I'm going to let them know that I caught them doing something right, even the little things. And I'm going to demonstrate this level of gratitude so many times, in so many different ways, that it's going to be impossible to ignore. And it's going to be infectious.
Right. Fine, but let's just say that, you thank your wife for delicious meals, and you thank her for all the things that she does. Let's say there's one thing that you really would like her to change, or there's one thing that she would really like you to change, or whatever. So how do you? When I first got married, like a year after I got married, almost 30 years ago, my wife and I took a course. It was called How to Fight Fairly. And it talked about don't scream but sit down, talk about it.
So I have one more for you.
Okay.
If the first two didn't.
Okay.
One more for you.
Well, the idea that you just mentioned about to show the appreciation, I think that's great, and I'm sure it helps a marriage.
But just to be clear, the idea wasn't to show appreciation. The idea was to demonstrate in a fanatical way whatever it is that you're looking for. Appreciation was just an example.
I missed that point.
What would be another example of that? Like,
let's say physical affection. So you can demonstrate physical affection, both to your wife and also to your kids. Elevate the level of physical affection. Have your kids sit on your lap more. Let's say mutual consent. You know, you can be really sensitive about coming to your wife on a very regular basis, getting her input on all sorts of decisions that have to be made in the family and in your life. She's going to start wondering, like, my God, you're soliciting my involvement in so much. She might even say, why are you doing that? Okay, now she's opened the door. I'm doing it because I think it's good for us. I would love, getting back to my first technique, I love it when you solicit my input on how to parent the children.
Can I interject for a second?
Yeah, sure.
So, like, if I understand correctly, you're saying, like, be the change that you want to see in your partner? Is that what you mean? Like,
yeah.
Do you want them to be doing something, then you should really be making that change clear in your own way. Setting your own example.
In a fanatical way.
One second. So what would happen, here's on my notes, you have the courage and consideration. And what if your spouse is too extreme the other way? Let's say your spouse is too considerate. So how do you be the change and set the example that you want them to conform, let's say, to be a little bit more... I mean, this probably should make more sense in the other direction. Okay, let's say that one spouse is too controlling, and you want them to be less controlling. So I don't think being fanatically controlling would help them be less controlling. I mean, right? Would you agree?
Right. So your example is that one spouse is too controlling?
One spouse is too controlling. Yeah.
Right. So what you want to demonstrate is the balance between courage and consideration. And that's what, you don't just want them to be less controlling, you want them to be balanced with courage and consideration, so you can demonstrate that. Mm-hmm. And in the case of somebody who's overboard on consideration, by the way, you can draw out of them the courage. What do you think? What do you want here? What's your opinion? Do it however you want. You know best. No. That's the way it's been for the last 10 years. I need your help with this. I really want to know. What do you think? Really, whatever you want to do. Next day. I wanted to ask your opinion on something. The same thing. Didn't we talk about that yesterday? Yeah, but I'm not moving forward until I want your buy-in. What do you want? How would you do this? I can't move forward without you. We're in this together. I still feel like I didn't answer Jordan's questions. When they come back, I do have a third strategy. So, and this is maybe the primary one. So
do you mind if I just chime in? Maybe I'm not explaining my question right. Here's good. I know particularly, like, a lot of times, well, I guess all age couples, young, middle-aged, older couples, let's say, you know, one person is, when it comes to the Yiddish kind, one person's, you know, wants to do a lot more. I think, what did he say with the term, huh?
Fanatical.
So all of a sudden, for one spouse to just all of a sudden become fanatical, I don't think that's going to get the other to do anything other than probably
do less.
Right. So not every technique works in every situation. You're right. That would not be a good idea.
But that is but use that as an example, let's just say.
So the example is that...
All the other things about, look, you know, pointing out the good qualities and, you know, use that as an example.
Differences in religion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me a more specific example? Because in many cases, in many cases, I think the appropriate thing to do when there's differences in Yiddishkeit, in many cases, it's not something we do together.
Well, I hear about,
let me just cover this, even though it may not be. In many cases with Yiddishkeit, it's not something we do together. And so I should just keep my mouth shut. I should do my thing and allow my wife the space to do her thing. And everybody grows spiritually at different times in different ways. And it's not my job to be the religious police.
Well, that's a good answer.
Now, sometimes it's something we do together.
Right.
The dishes. I mean, she doesn't care about plates. She's got milk. It's not really working. You know what I'm saying?
When it comes to raising kids,
and you're on a different level, you want to grow, and you feel like your spouse isn't doing as much, then that's having an effect on the kids. You feel like, you know, let's say you don't want a TV in the house, and your wife is okay with the TV in the house, right? So, where does that leave you?
With the TV in the attic.
But you have the whole family in that, I guess.
Yeah.
But things also can't change in the last minute. Obviously, if this is what the family is like for the last 20 years, you had a TV in the house. If you wake up tomorrow and decide you don't want a TV because now you're more religious, it has to be a gradual thing. That's what the give and take is. If I'm becoming more religious, I think it's what you're saying, I have to do certain things in a nice way, and hopefully she'll join me eventually, but I can't decide tomorrow, well, I don't want a TV, too bad. That's not negotiating and talking with your wife and coming to an equal, even if it's for right now, your kids might be suffering from the TV, but you can't just decide that overnight you have a marriage. I think that's what you're saying, right?
I mean, some of these examples, I admit, are so difficult and complicated, I don't have answers to them. Like, for example, you know, someone wakes up one day, they don't want to keep kashas.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, how do you eat from the same, I don't know, I've never had the case.
Paper plates.
I'm not sure. Paper plates. But I do want to offer one other option. It's an important one. An alternative to criticize, condemn, and complain. And that is to use an I feel sentence.
An I feel sentence.
Let me explain. So, of course, as soon as you start to, you know, criticize, condemn, and complain, your spouse's defenses go up. I mean, everybody understands this doesn't work. We all want our spouse to be sensitive to us. What does that mean, to be sensitive to us? It means we want them to change their behavior to accommodate our feelings. But if we want them to change their behavior to accommodate our feelings, they have to know how we feel. Now that sounds obvious, and you might think, well, what do you mean? Of course she knows how I feel, I've told her 100 times. And anyway, even if I didn't tell her, isn't it obvious? The problem is that it's usually not so obvious to our spouse, because they have their own thoughts and own feelings that they're focused on. And yeah, you've told her 100 times, but usually when you tell her by saying you do, you are, you always, you never. Like, we criticize, condemn, and complain. We attack. And when we speak to somebody that way, they don't hear a word we're saying. So we think we've communicated our feelings, and they haven't really heard a thing. So an alternative is to deliver an I feel sentence. There are 2 steps to the I feel sentence. The first step is, I feel, and then to finish the sentence authentically. So I feel ignored, I feel dominated, I feel, whatever it is that you feel. Now, of course, you should do this at the time that your spouse is doing something that is hurtful. If you do that, they'll make an immediate connection between their behavior and your feeling. You don't have to tell them. They'll figure it out all by themselves. You've already accomplished something, right? You see that they are feeling responsible for the feeling that they elicited based on their actions. As they should. Now I say as they should because I believe I'm responsible for my wife's feelings. I believe my wife is responsible for my feelings. Responsible in the sense that responsible for being sensitive to them. Again, that means changing my behavior to accommodate her feelings. So as soon as I deliver an I feel sentence, she immediately makes the connection between her behavior and my feelings. And she has the opportunity, I don't know if she'll take it, She might blow it, but at least I've given her the opportunity to change her behavior to accommodate my feelings. I haven't demanded it. I haven't screamed at her. I've allowed her to make the connection and given her the opportunity to be a hero, so to speak. She can feel good about it if she does it. Now, remember I said there's two steps to the I feel sentence. The first step is the I feel sentence, which will transfer a burden of responsibility to your spouse, which again, I don't mean that in a negative way. I think that's appropriate. And hopefully, you know, she'll take advantage of that. The second step is the most important step after the I feel sentence. It's the hardest one. You'll pardon my language. It's to shut up. Shut up. Don't say another word. Because as soon as she feels the burden of responsibility, she's going to try to get out from under that burden of responsibility and put it back on you. Those are your feelings. That's your problem. And she'll do that by trying to drag you into a conversation that will result in you saying, you do, you are, you always, you never. The defenses go up. She doesn't have it. You're back to the beginning. I feel, and don't say another word. She will try to engage you in a conversation that will release her of the burden. Don't say another word. And she'll be stuck with, I feel. And she'll be stuck with the burden of responsibility. Again, I don't mean that in a negative way. We are responsible for changing our behavior to accommodate our spouse's feelings.
Seems like you're trapping her a little bit.
I was going to say, it's like checkmate.
Yeah. That sentence feels like you're opening up for a conversation and then you deny her the right to the conversation with a sentence like that. That's...
Hey, try it.
Is this working? Is your marriage working?
I mean, it goes both ways. It's not a game. It's not chess. Look, if I want her to be sensitive to me, it's my responsibility to give her the opportunity to be sensitive to me. I have to do two things to give her that opportunity. I have to communicate how I feel, and I have to do that in a way that she can hear it. If you have other ideas as to how to accomplish those two things, I would love to learn from you. I'm open to it. But I think that does it. You know? And does it result in them feeling a little burden? It does. But I think I've helped them take responsibility. If I'm behaving in a way that's hurtful to my wife, and I don't feel a little guilty about that, something's wrong with me. I should feel bad about that. But maybe I don't, and maybe she has to help me get to that place.
One thing that I found, I'll call it a tweak to that, and I totally agree with the approach. One thing I found as a tweak is people generally think of the word responsibility as it's on me. You know, okay. I try to very quickly intervene and say, let's take a look at the word responsibility. I take it apart. It means the ability to respond, not the weight on your shoulder, but an empowerment. You have the ability to respond.
Right.
And who wouldn't want to increase their, as Freud would say, to expand the horizons of the ego, to increase their opportunity to be able to respond to many situations, including your spouse feeling ignored.
Right.
So do you want to respond to that? Do you have a response? Can you respond? And then it's not blame. It's,
right.
Works sometimes. Sometimes not.
Sometimes it doesn't. But at least you have some things to try. Nothing works all the time. It's a relationship and they're complicated. The idea is to increase your tools.
Mm-hmm.
How are we doing on time? What's the schedule?
I feel we're good.
We're good, meaning?
I was just throwing out the I feel thing.
You didn't shut up, though.
No, not doing it again.
Busted.
Hey,
want to try another?
Sure.
Wait,
sure.
sure is.
Depends how you define winning.
Thank you. Good point.
Should one push his wife to learn Torah? To Torah classes for women. I can't read some of this, but I get the idea. I wonder if we should push our wives to do anything.
Right.
Like, no one likes to be pushed.
The answer is in the size of the paper. It's such a small piece of paper. So you shouldn't push.
Yeah. I don't think we should push our wives to do anything. You know, persons... The gate to a person's heart, they hold it. You know, we shouldn't be trying to play with it or manipulate it or control it. We can be a powerful example. We can be encouraging. We can try to create family experiences that promote learning and growth in Torah. I mean, I think there's a lot we can do to influence the likelihood that they take that step. At the end of the day, it's up to them, and it's never good to push. You know, it's you'll create a negative environment. It's not advisable. I don't have anything else to say about that. How do you overcome the desire of looking at other women? The desire to look at another woman is natural, spontaneous, it's impulsive. I don't think one chooses to have that desire. It's not a choice. So I don't know that you can control that. You didn't choose it to begin with, so I'm not sure you can choose not to have the desire. However, you can choose how to behave in the face of the desire. And I think that's, I think, the more compelling question is, how do I act? What should I do in the face of that desire? You know, feelings just emerge. They're natural, they're spontaneous, we don't choose them. But we can choose what to do, you know, in the face of those feelings. So, you know, if I'm angry at my kids, I might feel like yelling. But I can choose to speak in a calm voice. If I'm upset with my wife, I could feel like criticizing, condemning, and complaining. But I could choose to use an I feel sentence. So too, you know, I think it's pretty natural for a man to have his attention drawn away occasionally by the look of another woman. But I can choose to quickly look away and not continue to look. Right? I can choose to have proper filters on my computer so that I don't then take another step after I have that thought and do something inappropriate. By the way, I can't resist a quick tangent. I think it's called Webchaver. Everybody know that Webchaver? I mean, in my humble opinion, you know, there's not a man in the community that shouldn't have this on his computer.
What's it called? Webchaver?
Webchaver, I think. The product is called Covenant Eyes. Mm-hmm. I think Webchaver is the name of the company, I think. I could look it up for you, but anyway, basically,
it's a
Jewish company
that uses the Covenant Eyes software.
It's a Jewish company, and all the websites that you visit are sent to whatever person you want it sent to.
Cover.
So you can have it sent to your Rav, your brother, your wife. I have it sent to my wife, and I actually think, in going back to dating, I think this is another important question for a potential husband and wife to discuss. On a bigger scale, bigger picture, for a potential husband and wife to talk about the role that technology is going to play in their family and how they're going to manage that and what their vision is for their children. My observation is that this is one of the defining issues, you know, of our generation. How a family chooses to deal with technology is you know, in many ways defines what goes on in the family, how the children grow up, what their influences are. I mean, it used to be that, you know, it used to be to do something really bad. You know, you had to walk into the middle of town and be willing to be seen in places that nobody would be willing to be seen. And today, it's all right here.
Yeah.
And it's you know, I'm sure you know from your work.
One little vignette, sort of a general thing. Without sounding modest, I've had a lot of success helping people with depression, anxiety, quitting even smoking and drugs and alcohol. The thing I've had the least success at is getting families who are TV families to agree to turn off their TV for 1 hour a night.
Yeah.
I've had the least success at that.
Yeah.
24/7.
It'd probably be easier to get them to get rid of the television.
Maybe.
Once you have it, to not watch. But anyway, so WebCobber is a great great tool to keep us honest. You know, fact of the matter is people behave differently when someone's watching. It's just natural. And so this is a tool, someone's always watching. And every man in the firm community should have this on their devices. So anyway, the question was, you know, how do you overcome the desire? So I'm not sure that you can really overcome the desire. I think that's natural, but you can make intelligent decisions in the face of the desire. And I'll contradict something I just said, and I think the more you succeed to do that, the less the desire strikes you. Right? There's the story of the grandfather's walking along the beach with his son, grandson, and says to his grandson, "I feel like there's two wolves inside of me fighting for control." The grandson says, "Well, which one wins?" The grandfather says, "Whichever one I feed." Yeah, it's really true. I've had some good success working with some men who have struggled with pornography. And the key to the success that I've had with them is it's somewhat counter to what's going on out there, somewhat counter to, I don't know what your opinion is on this, but pornography is being referred often as an addiction. And addiction, as soon as we say addiction, we think of like an alcoholic, we think of 12 steps, and some of these pornography programs are kind of based on 12 steps. But I think there's a real inherent problem with that approach. An addiction means I'm not in control. That there's some, you know, there's a chemical thing going on inside of me. I don't have control over it. In fact, with alcohol, with heroin, and it's true, right? It's true. And that's why 12 steps is so successful, because the beginning of 12 steps is I don't have control and I turn myself over to a higher power and to this community. And that's the beginning of the success. There's a lot of discussion as to whether or not pornography and sex-oriented things are addictions. I think the problem with looking at it as an addiction is that the next natural step is that I'm not in control. And that's a huge problem, because I find that the key to solving the problem is to help this person understand that you are in control. This is not an addiction, it's a bad habit. And we overcome bad habits by learning to make better choices. And that's the real work that has to be done, is how do I fortify my decision-making ability? And so so addiction is just, in my opinion, the wrong direction. And I remember working with one guy in particular, it's kind of the classic story I tell, who's suffered this for years and years and years and worked with therapists and And I had him on the right track after, like, literally two sessions. It was just a matter of, he was so convinced that he was powerless. And where does somebody go with that? But as soon as I had him understand, you're in control here. This is your choice. He felt very empowered. And then it was just a matter of discussing how to make better choices.
Can I just talk about that?
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, you mentioned sources for things? Do you have any sources in particular for that idea that supports your view?
I don't, but there are sources for it. I mean, if this is a debate, right? This is
I couldn't agree with you more, though. I think calling it an addiction is a cop-out.
Yeah, I agree. Exactly. It's a big debate. There's lots of people that are quick to call it an addiction, and there's even programs based on the 12 steps.
Guard your eyes.
There's 12 steps for sex addicts anonymous, those kinds of things.
This is a home site too. Guard your eyes. And some, gye.com, something like this. I think Rabbi Chorsky's involved with it.
It's a very new. It's a relatively new.
They kind of treat it. They kind of treat it as an addiction. Probably getting. It depends where you're at.
Mm. What's your best advice for a new father?
Enjoy.
Get sleep while you can.
Best advice for a new father is have a date night with your son or daughter.
That's right.
Once a week, sacred time.
You mean the baby, or you mean the other kids?
Well, if it's a baby, I mean, you could. It's a good habit to get into. Mm-hmm. It's more meaningful when they get older. But two things I've found really meaningful in my own experience as a father is date night and also two-day trips. I have one next week, actually, with my daughter, my 8-year-old daughter. I'm taking her to New York City, 2 days and one night. And I do this, I try to do this once a year with every child. Just a special time for just me and that one child. We, Baruch Hashem, we have 5 children. So many of you probably have large families, and you know that with a large family, it's sometimes hard to give one child real focused attention, you know, but they need it. So that date night and those two-day trips are kind of regular reminders to them that they get my full attention.
Is it for both parents together, or
no.
Each parent should be doing it, or just the father?
Well, it depends on the family. I mean, in my wife's case, you know, she spends a tremendous amount of time with my 8-year-old daughter. So, I mean, that's not relevant for them. And she used to homeschool the other kids before Moshe and Nachshon went to Norfolk. You know, they were homeschooled. So it was kind of different for her. You know, because
other people, like, what?
Well, it depends. I mean, in a more traditional family where the mom is spending a tremendous amount of time with the kids.
But not one-on-one.
If not one-on-one, then it's a nice idea. But I think particularly in a family where, you know, like in our family, you know, like where I'm working every day, and, you know, I have minimal amount of time at night where I spend some time with them, and of course Shabbos, but I mean, most of you know what it's like, you know. So, you know, to have 2 days where, you know, you're not working, and, you know, we're going to the Central Park Zoo, and we're going to go ice skating and warm a drink, and she's going to play her violin in Central Park, and, you know, it's just like, you know, time to,
awesome.
to where she feels like she's the most important thing in my life.
Where did you get that idea from?
Stephen Covey.
You want sources for everything.
Right, you have to.
You want to know where he got the drinks?
He's a Kollel guy. That's what we do all day.
By the way, other than if in terms of a secular source for great family stuff, I can't recommend enough Covey's material. I don't know how many of you are familiar.
How do you spell his last name?
Covey.
Seven habits, you know, the seven habits.
The ability to respond. I don't know if you got it from him, but I've heard that from him. You know.
One of his best things is the 4-square, where you try and use your time priorities, which being quadrant 2 is very powerful.
The book is 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Just to follow up one more question. We were talking about pornography and religion. Is that, like, let's say one's husband is into pornography, would you advise the wife not to push her husband to work on the pornography issue because, like, when it comes to religion, give them their space? I don't want to be the religious police in the house.
Something else.
Or would you say this is a little different?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that it's just a religious matter. I mean, certainly it's a religious matter, but pornography is a matter beyond religion also. I mean, it's a relationship matter. I mean, it's a form of betrayal. It's admonished a form of betrayal. So it's a marital matter. It's a religious matter. It's a parenting matter. I mean, chas v'shalom, kids should stumble across and realize their father's doing such a thing. I mean, and it happens. You know, it happens. So, that's a good example of where we have to be able to balance courage with consideration and exercise good judgment in what's called for. I would say with a case like that, it calls for courage. I mean, a woman has to find opportunities to try to have an impact, to try to do something. A woman just can't sit idle and do nothing while her husband is soiling his soul. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I don't have a magic answer, you know, because at the end of the day, he has to be willing to choose not to do it. But that's an excellent example of that judgment that's required. Does this call for courage? Does this call for consideration? That is a really important matter that she's got to try to influence. At least it's easier in the firm community. I mean, in the secular community, I deal with mostly people in the secular community, is a huge problem because when it comes to pornography, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a matter of choice. Right. In other words, their attitude is like, everybody does it. What's the big deal? So you can't even come at it from a perspective of like right and wrong. There's no, they don't see it that way. You know, you have to come at it from more of a sort of, you know, consequences and effect and, you know,
this is backwards, but we really didn't get to know you or your background or how you got interested in marital counseling. So I saw you have an interesting resume online. You went to Wharton. You're a marathon runner and you're an expert.
That was a long time ago. I just turned 52 last week.
All right. Can you just tell us how you got interested and what your background is? Which you have to stay quite fast.
Yeah. So that's a long story. It's also I'll just say very briefly. My background's very eclectic. I went to Penn, and I worked on Wall Street for a few years after Penn, and I had a direct mail advertising company, which I sold when I was 29. And then my wife and I bought a one-way ticket to Bangkok. We were not from. In fact, wow. Didn't know anything. Didn't even know the alphabet. Bought a one-way ticket to Bangkok, and we traveled around the world for about a year. And it was really a travel of the heart, as much as anything else. And I spent some time in a Buddhist monastery, and was in Thailand, and Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam. At the end of that travels, went to Israel. That's where I started to learn a little bit, and that turned on to Torah. And then I learned for a few years after that, full-time, but not really like the classic yeshiva learning. I was more interested in like the philosophy of Torah, and like, I was learning like a lot of Rav Soloveitchik, and I never really got turned on to the nuts and bolts of like Gomorrah learning. Whatever. So I was more interested in like the big picture questions that I explored with a lot of Torah thought. And then I worked for a Jewish organization for a number of years. And then we had many years ago, we had two children. first we had a son who died when he was very young, and it was really difficult, and then not that long after, we had twin daughters who also didn't make it. So this really was like this threw us into a marital crisis. And I'm giving you a very long story, very short. But we started to reach out for help. And we're kind of horrified with the quality of the help that was available to couples that were in crisis. In short, everybody was asking us to focus on our problems, and we found that the more we talked about the problems, the worse things got. We like became mired in all the negativity of our situation. Eventually we put aside all those problems and issues, and we just started like being decent to each other and doing good things that were healthy for us. And that really turned things around for us. And I mean, at the time, I had no idea that I'd be doing something like this. But once we kind of got through that crisis, we looked at what we did, and we really felt like we had a responsibility to understand what did we do that was right, and could we share that with the world. So I spent about 10 hours a day in the library for 6 months, writing out all these thoughts and ideas and everything we had experienced and everything we had done that we felt that worked, and making a little and doing a little critique on what we felt didn't work as well. And I didn't really know if I had anything. I called it Marriage Fitness. It was a book. It is a book. And I don't know, I thought maybe I would just print a few copies for my kids and then move on to whatever else I was going to do. But I started sending it around, and Baruch Hashem, it got attention. And it was actually endorsed by John Gray, who's the author of Mars Venus, as well as Stephen Covey. And it was picked up in the Library Journal, and was on some television, national television stations, and it got attention. And I got kind of affirmation that I really had something here. And so I used that then to develop the self-help program based on the book called The Marriage Fitness Tele Bootcamp, which is like this multimedia self-help program for couples that are in marital crisis. And it's like, in short, it's a little bit of the path.
Very nice. Thank you. Really great. It's amazing. So many successful businesses get started because somebody was looking around. Like in your case, you were so dismayed by what was out there to help, so you didn't fix it yourself. That's a lot of successful companies come about that way.
Baruch Hashem, I had the support of my wife, and we both really believe, and we teach our children that they should do what they love to do. Like, passion is what drives contribution and success. I'm not talking about financial success, but I mean, like, to make a difference, you have to believe in it, you have to have passion. Just a little bit of a critique in the firm community. I mean, I find that so many people look at, their career choice from really like a parnassa perspective, what kind of lifestyle am I going to have? How much money am I going to make? Those things are motivating for about a week, I find. I think it's the people who really do what they love to do. It's like their calling. And you do it because you love to do it. And then you'll be good at it. And you'll make a difference in people's lives, and they'll pay you for it. that's what we believe.
That's great.
Anyway, thank you all so much for coming to my home.